And that little bit of special introduction music was requested by Mark Radulich. I say requested, I mean ordered. He's the boss. And, you know, I got... Mark, real quick, before I do the whole introduction spiel, is that actually a didgeridoo in there, or did they synthesize that?
I'm going to go with synthesize.
All right, because if it was actually a didgeridoo, I was going to have to be happy about it, because... I like didgeridoos. Hello, everyone. This is not a music podcast, although we do accommodate that particular taste here on the Radulich and Broadcasting Network. This is the Movie Review Club. That's kind of what we're going with here. Again, I change the name every week until I find something that I like. I'm Robert Winfrey, host of this bad boy, and thank you all for listening. Again, I say this on most of my shows, but thanks for listening. Your support, your patronage, your, you know, subscriptions, comments, criticisms, we appreciate it all. It means a lot to us to know that people are out there listening and bothering to care about this. The only really, again, finite resource we all have is time, and you're choosing to give us of your time. So thank you for that a lot. I appreciate it a great deal. Tonight we're reviewing the number two movie in America, Inside Out. Didn't topple Jurassic World, because nothing beats Chris Pratt and trained raptors, apparently. People, we deserve better. We deserve better than that, or we should. Demand better. We don't deserve it, because apparently we're still paying for it. But Pixar's latest, release, Inside Out. And Pixar, the studio that makes you want to take your kids to it, and then they wind up looking at you and going, Mom, Dad, why are you crying at this movie? And you want to yell at them, shut up, you'll understand when you're older. Because they probably will. And helping me out here is Mark Radulich, our, you know, the spiritual patriarch of the Radulich and Broadcasting Network, our founder and my boss, who doesn't have to pay me for this because we don't make any money. Yeah, seriously, we want to grow the brand so we can start making money doing this. He doesn't want to do what he does for a living. I don't want to do what I do for a living. I want to do this for a living. So everybody out there, continue growing the brand. Mark, apart from me putting you on the spot about, you know, Aerosmith and their propensity for Australian instruments, how are you doing this evening?
I'm good. Okay, a couple of things right off the bat. I have to do some cleanup now. One, we chose I chose Sweet Emotion for the opening because it was in the trailer or in the teaser, one of the two. So
I never saw it.
When they first did the teaser for Inside Out a few months back, it was over Sweet Emotion. So I was like, okay, well that's what we're going to go with then. So, you know, it wasn't just completely out of the clear blue sky. Two, and I think I mentioned this when we actually talked about it. During the Battle of Five Armies, there was a girl sitting next to me who bawled her ever-loving eyes out when the two dwarf cousins to,
Feely and Keely, and they are killed by Azog the Destroyer, and then he kills Thorin.
Yes. When Feely and Keely buy the farm, this girl bawled her ever-loving... was like hyperventilating. This girl was completely unhinged. And I was almost at that level of hysterical, snotty sadness with this movie. To the point where I was embarrassed, okay? Like, I'm trying to hold back, because... You know, like, look, I cry at a lot of things. I'm hyper-emotional. I've been hyper-emotional for my entire life. My wife is nodding her head furiously. But, you know, my mother is hyper-emotional. I'm hyper-emotional. And then it's been made worse by the fact that I work in a field where you have to empathize with people. In any case, so it's I cry easily. I cry a lot of stuff. Revenge of the Nerds.
Scare easily.
Yes, I also scare easily. Revenge of the Nerds, I boo-hoo cry. So, what? We are the champions. They finally won one at the end. I get emotional. In any case, but I do understand how to compose myself, especially when I'm out with my daughter, and I'm really trying to hold back, just kind of cry silently. No, I was bawling, openly weeping throughout this movie. And, like, making noise and trying to stifle it, which made it sound even worse. So what you get is a sort of strangled jackal sound, kind of a, Like I sound like I'm trying to fit my fat ass through a through too tiny of a door space is what it sounds like.
Oh yeah, I understand the I understand how that is. This I was like that with the at the end of Toy Story 3. That was that was very that was my one where I'm sitting there in the theater fighting like, okay, you can cry, but for the love of all that's holy, don't sob.
I wasn't as bad as I was. This is the worst I've ever cried at any movie. And what made it worse, and we were talking about this on Messenger. I've told the story about Up many times. My wife and I have discussed it many times. She's actually sitting with me right now. At least with Up, it's the first 10 minutes, and then it's over, and the whole tone of the movie changes. This is almost the entire third act. So we're talking, a half an hour of the movie pretty much is this very like hyper emotional, sad, tear jerking thing. And so that's a long time to try to hold back tears.
Yeah. That's,
before we go, hang on.
That's a lot.
Look, before we go any further, I want to hand you back the levers of the show, but my daughter looks like she's going to pass out any minute now. So for fun and affection, here is my four-year-old daughter, Lily Catherine Rattledge. Lily, welcome to the show.
Say hi.
Okay. She just gave me this death glare and covered her eyes.
She doesn't understand this is an audio. This is, not a visual medium.
Lily, what did you think of Inside Out? Did you like it?
Yeah.
Okay. Who was in the movie, Lily?
George, Wilson, and man.
Who was the red guy? The red guy with the flaming head.
That sounds a lot like Daddy.
The new guy with the red fire.
Okay, what was his name? Do you remember?
His name was,
Anger.
Anger.
Yeah, he was mad all the time, right?
Yeah.
Okay, did you like the movie?
Yeah.
Yeah? What did you like about the... What was your favorite thing about Inside Out?
Inside Out was just Joy.
Your favorite character was Joy?
Yeah.
Why was your favorite character Joy? What was great about Joy?
Joy makes Scrawny... Riley.
Joy makes everything happy?
She made Riley happy.
She made Riley happy. Thank you. Okay.
Here I was hoping it was she played the accordion.
Is there anything else you would like to tell our audience who is anxiously awaiting your thoughts about this movie?
About the movie, it's nice.
Okay. Slugs.
Yeah, we're never going to top that. I was really hoping to get, I was really hoping she was going to say it, but I'm a ballerina, and then you would have to narrate her twirling out of the room.
Well, if I start punching her, then she will say, I'm a ballerina, and spin out of the room, but this is not the MMA podcast. All right, so that was the impression from the four-year-old, and you've got my overall reaction to it, which was, by the end of that movie, I had a horrible freaking headache. I mean, after a while, when you have to hold back that much, and it's just like a shaken up soda can, it's like you're trying to hold it, but
the pressure, it builds.
Right. I mean, but like I said, by the end of it, I was like, let's go home. Daddy has a migraine. So there we go.
Well, let me go ahead and throw real briefly the plot of this thing out here. Now that we've, had the most comprehensive review we're going to get of the evening, because Mark and I are going to go all over the place. I'll warn everyone beforehand. If this is your introduction to Mark and I doing movie reviews, you're in for a treat, because we go all over the place, and I don't think we're going to yell at each other, which is a step up from our last few where we have yelled at each other, although those tend to be the more entertaining ones. All right, tell me I'm lying, okay? Because I know I'm not. Inside Out is told from the perspective of a 11, 12-year-old girl named Riley, most of it focuses on her emotions, which exist within her, inside of her brain, and they all have individual personalities. It's Pixar. You know what they do as far as that goes. They turn, you know, inanimate or abstract thoughts into characters and give them feelings and motivations and whatnot, and they excel at it. And that's what they do here with five of the six primary emotions that humans feel. Joy, sadness, anger, fear, and disgust. The sixth is surprise, but surprise and fear would be a tad redundant in the movie, so they axed it. And if you're not appealing to children, then disgust is actually contempt, but contempt is too abstract and perhaps too malevolent a concept to put into a kid's movie, so disgust instead of contempt. Don't ask me why I know all those things. It's really not worth the energy to explain, but I know those things. As 12-year-old girls are prone to do, she is a little bit emotionally unbalanced. Just because, again, you're 12. You're coming into your teenage years. You're going to be a little bit out of balance emotionally. Her family moves from Minnesota to San Francisco, so there's a monumental culture clash, plus, you know, the... And I don't want to say trauma, but, you know, the reality of being uprooted and then leaving again, going, you know, halfway across the country. A lot of this is, and then a lot of the conflict stems from the interactions between joy and sadness, those two emotions, and them is struggling kind of to come to grips with each other.
Parallel plots. We have the outside world where not only does she move from her the known, which is Minnesota, to the unknown, which is San Francisco, but San Francisco sucks on almost every level. You know, her pizza joint serves pizza with broccoli.
They ruined pizza! Freaking San Francisco. I agreed with Lewis Black's anger as far as that went.
Yeah. Her house, you know, is a row house in the city of San Francisco instead of, you know, the big ranch-style house that she had in Minnesota with the yard and all that. You know, she's having to restart school again. She isn't sure if she can play hockey. So there's the real life that they don't have their clothing. They don't have any of their stuff. So she's sleeping on the floor in a room that's, you know, that's not particularly appealing to her. So there's the known to unknown and nothing going right plot that's going on in the real world. Inside Riley's head, you have I think the main plot of the movie, the driving force of this thing, which is that Joy is the alpha of the group. She is the one running the show. She is the one giving dictates and leading the pack. And to the exclusion of Sadness, who feels like she has no place because up to this point the object was to make Riley a joyful, if you will, character, a joyful little girl. But, so Sadness, feeling excluded from the group and without purpose, starts doing things, messing with core memories, messing with non-core memories, and this causes her and Joy to be expelled from, quote-unquote, headquarters. Get it? Because it's in her head. And what you have is a typical buddy cop adventure film where they're trying to get the core memories, which have also been expelled, back into Riley's headquarters. In the meantime, she has no core memories, nothing that connects her to her old personality, and fear, disgust, and anger are running the show in absentia, which causes hilarity then ensues. Take it away, Robert.
Because if those are your three primary emotions, you know, things are in... I laughed. The whole dinner scene was actually in one of the trailers. And it didn't matter. It was still funny when I sat there watching it live. Again, most of this takes place in Riley's head, but there are moments when we back out and we see other people's emotional centers and whatnot. And there's a dinner scene where Riley has just had a bad day at school, her first day in San Francisco school system, which has to be awful, I would assume. And again, Joy and Sadness are now out. They are in long-term memory, and they are trying to find their way back. Incidentally, there were some fun stuff in terms of visually representing, you know, abstract concepts, you know, the train of thought being an actual train that goes all over the place, which I chuckled at.
I like the islands of personality, you know, family, goofiness, hockey. I like that. I like the, you know, long-term memory. I like the concept of memories being, you know, these marvels, essentially. I enjoyed, you know, the constructs of her mind, that she is not using, kind of lost and without purpose. I enjoyed all of that. The one, I enjoyed that, you know, memories that she's no longer actively using eventually turn to dust. I liked all of
except
that.
Except for that bubblegum jingle.
I'll get there in a minute. What I actually thought, the only thing I wasn't a fan of was the train of thought. It just felt like it a little too on the nose for me, because I feel like the train didn't really go anywhere. I don't know what purpose it was serving. It was just like, oh, we have trains of thought, so here's a train of thought. And I was like, ah. And they use it as part of the plot, which is fine, but it, like I said, a little too on the nose for me, a little too obvious. I didn't think it was one of Pixar's best inventions, at least in this movie. Which is not to say I didn't like the movie or anything else like that. I think you can think a movie is great. I think you can give a movie 5 stars and still find things that were not, you know, in one's opinion, not great.
Yeah, fair enough. I liked it. Elements of this reminded me of a movie I read a lot as a kid called The Phantom Tollbooth. I don't know if anyone else out there has actually read that, but it deals a lot with kind of the same thing of taking things that are literal and then transporting them into the physical world and whatnot. I don't want to talk about the book too much. It's one of those things that I think everyone or a lot of people kind of in their, you know, preteens, before you actually get out of primary school and into secondary, you wind up reading at one point or another.
There's a Tex Avery cartoon where a cat sends. This is how you know Robert's smarter than I. He quotes books. I quote Tex Avery cartoons. But there's a Tex Avery cartoon where I think it's a dog or a cat that gets tired of people and sends itself to the moon. And on the moon are literal translations of things. So, you know, or just really goofy stuff. So you've got like a fire hydrant chasing a dog, that kind of thing. You've got a pencil running away from a sharpener. That's good. That's kind of what the train of thought reminded me of.
Which is fair. And again, the train of thought exists in this movie as just basically a plot device to help get them home. And then, they don't even wind up using it. But it's funny enough for me. And again, if you think it's too on the nose and whatnot, it's not exactly wrong. It is very much on the nose. It's a literal train of thought.
Right.
I want to, again, you mentioned a little bit that you're, you know, emotionally sensitive. You have very heightened sensitivity to that stuff because of a bit of who you are and because of your job and whatnot. So I'm curious, because I was watching this, and is it just me, or is the Joy character kind of a dick?
Well, yeah, and that's what I said at the beginning. She's sort of this alpha of the group. She's taken it upon herself to decide that her role is to run the shop and make herself the primary emotion of the group. And while the other three still have a role to play, she absolutely minimizes. I mean, she's the reason this all happens, basically. I mean, you could say, oh, well, it's sadness. But, you know, it's funny because I was thinking about you and your podcast, which is Friday nights at 8 or 9 o'clock.
9 o'clock.
Everyone loves the bad guy. And in preparation for this podcast, I started thinking about what you might say about this, because there was no direct villain, but in a way, your antagonist is Joy. It's because Joy mistreats Sadness that Sadness starts to misbehave. And you might even go as far as to say she wasn't misbehaving. She was acting out of boredom.
Perform her normal duties.
Right. She wasn't acting out of any kind of maliciousness. But you have
Sadness
Joy
is important,
doing all of this.
And thankfully Joy realizes that at the end, which
right.
I appreciated.
So, you know, in the one sense, you know, it's joy that goes on the hero's arc, and, you know, and it's changed by the end of the movie. So in that sense, she's a protagonist. But she's the one that causes everything to become unraveled.
She freaks out at the thought that sadness, that one of the core memories of Riley's personality would become sad.
Right. And so in that sense, she's the I would call her the villain of this movie.
I would agree with that. Because, again, without that, I mean, a lot of this is external in the sense that, you know, kind of the bad stuff happens because of the move. But in terms of, you know, the interplay and whatnot, then, yeah, Joy's kind of the bad guy here. She tries to leave sadness behind when she first tries to get back to headquarters. She's more than willing to leave an extraordinarily and fundamentally integral part of how you mature emotionally because she would rather everything be happy.
Yeah. I'm going to use a movie as a kind of an analogy here, and you'll probably hate the movie, but let's not focus on that, my choice. Let's focus on what it means. The movie Liar Liar, Jim Carrey plays a terrible human being, but because of circumstances that cause him to have to constantly be truthful, he goes on this hero's arc and at the end becomes a better person because of it. But there are no other villains in the movie. He's it. He is the both antagonist and protagonist. He starts out shitty and ends up good by the end. And I would say that's what we have here. We have somebody who is sort of terrible, which is funny because, you know, you heard my daughter. My daughter's favorite character in this thing was Joy. But that's the impression of a 4-year-old. I don't know how many people really picked up the fact that Joy's kind of a terrible, you know, for lack of a better words, she's kind of a terrible person at the start of this. She has an inflated sense of purpose, and by the end of the movie, she sees herself as part of the team and not necessarily the leader.
Well, first of all, I actually like Liar Liar. This is one of those, I don't like most comedies by and large. They don't appeal to me, and they're not supposed to, given my sensibilities and whatnot. I happened to see Liar Liar when I was the right age to appreciate Jim Carrey's version of humor, and with the right people to just because comedy's also a social thing. Watching a comedic movie alone is no fun because it's generally not funny. You need to be with the right people so the groupthink can kick in and whatnot, and I mean that whole thing. But I have a very fond memories of Liar Liar, so I approve of your choice, even if it wasn't the movie itself. Your analogy is completely correct. There's very little manifestations of evil as far as this movie goes. I suppose if you're afraid of clowns, you have a truly terrifying moment that takes place in this movie. But other than that, and not being afraid of clowns myself, not at all, but I accept that most people are, so good on you. I really kind of want to talk about Joy for a bit. I mean, she's a character who is very much, for everyone who kind of, if you listen to our Tomorrowland review, I had that rant at the end of it, which was purely personal and, again, had very little to do with the actual context of the movie. But I very much felt like Joy was, okay, we're going to have to, you know, everything has to be happy, then you'll be a happy person, then you'll have a happy life, and job done. And then we can all check out 80 years from now, happy. And that's kind of, and she's mentioned that she actually has lines like that to that effect in the movie. And I have such faith in Pixar as a studio that I wasn't worried about them going too far with that. I actually liked they presented her point of view about that being, you know, childish and short-sighted. And her, you know, her moment of realization within, you know, kind of the memory dump, when she realizes how important, you know, sadness is, how important it is to have everything, to be an emotionally well-rounded and healthy person, was very, that was powerful for me because you finally get, it was nice to see it represented on film, you know, a lot of the crap that I've had to deal with, you know, again, a lot of people have told me over my life, well, you just need to think positive thoughts, and I want to kick them in the teeth. So I'm curious, again, at the end of the movie, we get a really interesting, an important moment when joy and sadness together kind of form a core memory. And it comes out and it's both blue and yellow, and then the core memories that she has in the kind of final sequence, all of them are amalgamations. There's anger and joy, there's fear and disgust, there's joy and sadness, there's sadness and... I mean, again, all of them, because you never feel one emotion completely absent of each other. I'm curious about this for you, because you work in the mental health field by and large. I was very happy that they arrived at that place where they let everyone know, no, it's okay. You know, again, emotions are complicated, and they framed it in such a way that even, you know, the kids in the audience who I was surrounded by kids when I saw this movie, I felt very odd about that being, you know, almost 30 and single and sitting in a movie theater surrounded by children and grandparents who were taking them to the movie. I kind of went, okay, I don't need a job. Could I have a larger neon sign over my head? Well, if I still had my beard. Okay, if I still had my beard going. But so as a mental health professional, and I give you that term because I think it's accurate, you know, the way they framed the emotions and kind of discussed emotional health, I thought it was very well done, and that it, you know, again, it translates to children very well, and this is a concept that's very important because, again, there's a lot of people who, you know, have been told over the years, you know, just be happy type of stuff, and that's not healthy, you know, and this presents that, it presents, the complicated nature of emotions in a very accurate but, again, simplistic way, and I'm sorry that's a very long question to kind of point at you.
Okay, a couple of things. One, I thought it was great how the movie ended. The part of the reason why I was sobbing so uncontrollably was Joy's realization that it is good and purposeful and normal for Riley to feel sad in certain situations, and that's what sadness's job is to express those feelings when the time calls for it. If you indulge me for a moment, let me explain a little bit of what I do. I work in booking at the county jail, and we get a lot of people that come in and they're upset. They are crying. They are angry. They are sad. They are frightened.
Have you ever appeared in either the jail series or any of the lockup television shows?
I've only been working there since November, so no. But okay. I have watched every time lockup goes to Hillsborough County or any of the jail series or Cops, I am glued to the TV. in any case, the problem is. We also have a mandate to stop people from hurting themselves, committing suicide, that sort of thing. So everyone's very hypersensitive to a person that comes in and, for all intents and purposes, is acting normal. And that's one of the things that I talk about with the inmates. When they're sitting in my chair and I'm going through the booking process with them and I'm performing a mental health screen and they're crying, there are people that would tell you, oh, they need to be put on a psychiatric observation because they're crying and they might commit suicide. And I argue against that, saying it is perfectly normal for someone to cry when they are being booked into jail, especially when they feel like they've been arrested under false pretenses. To say quite plainly, they didn't do anything. We get a lot of women who are arrested on domestic violence charges because the men that they are with know now how to manipulate the law and the investigating officer when they come out there, or the deputy. And so you have a lot of women who say, yeah, my 250-pound muscular MMA fighter boyfriend, apparently I shoved him away from me when he was trying to hurt me, and now I'm here for domestic violence. Well, Jesus, I can see why she's angry. I can see why she's sad. I can see why she's frustrated. And when you're feeling those emotions, it is quite normal for you to cry. At least some people. So I guess what I'm saying is my job a lot of times is to normalize perfectly rational emotions in situations that call for them. And when you're, and if you could take it back to the movie, when you have a situation where Riley feels disconnected from her environment and she misses her home, it's perfectly natural for her to cry. It absolutely makes sense. And that was the conclusion that Joy finally came to, was that she's doing more harm than good. She's doing more harm than good by trying to make Riley feel happy about a situation that is actually making her miserable. And for whatever reason, that affected me deeply, and that is why I came completely unglued at the end of this movie.
The end, for me at least, kind of the ending sequence there where she finally breaks down and talks to her parents about being unhappy with the move and whatnot, there were people around me who were more affected by that than I was, and I realized why rather quickly, because I've been there. Many times, I don't talk about, you know, I mean, you talk about your job for providing context every now and then. I don't talk about myself a whole lot because I don't feel it adds anything to most of these discussions. But for the purposes of this one, this is, again, a girl who's upset about having to move. Now, the average human moves, what, 5 times in their lifespan? You move maybe once when you're a kid. You move, again, going to college, finding a job. You might move once after you have a job. Yeah, again, it probably averages out to somewhere between 5 and 6, probably like 5.7, moves in your entire life. And they're always, again, I hate to say traumatic because that's slightly over-dramatizing things, but they are changes and they do impact you. I moved a lot when I was a kid. My dad was in the Army. I got moved, and this was, you know, the early 90s when Clinton was deciding I have to pay for Medicaid and I'm going to shut down every military base I deem non-essential. And for me, that meant before I added a second digit to my age, I had lived in Utah, California, Washington, Arizona, North Dakota, and Oregon. So I'm a lot more emotionally okay with, you know, moving and kind of the baggage that comes with that. So, and again, to other people, it triggered a lot stronger memories than it did for me, I guess. But hey, it still bothers. I mean, because again, I've been there, so it still, you know, tugs at the old heartstrings a little bit. I also have I've helped too many people move too. I hate that I know how to load trucks efficiently. It bothers me on a deep level for some reason. We need to talk here, coming into, you know, the last half hour, give or take. There's a supporting character that we haven't touched on yet, who is really the most tragic figure. One of the most tragic figures Pixar has ever put on screen in a lot of ways, and that is Riley's imaginary friend Bing Bong, voiced by Richard Kind. More than anything else, I think his kind of story and arc got to me, and there's a variety of reasons for that that I may or may not go into. But, I mean, everyone had an imaginary friend when they were a kid. We all have vague recollections of having an imaginary friend. But we are introduced to this character as, you know, Riley is becoming a teenager, and there's no more need for him. And he's, you know, wandering, you know, the recesses of long-term memory, you know, very much kind of trying to find something to do with himself. He helps them out along the way. His story ends, actually, to start the third arc. He helps Joy escape the memory dump, which is where all memories go to die and fade away, but he can't get out. And he winds up staying behind and fading away and is completely forgotten. And more than anything, I think, I mean, that his, when he fades away, I mean, there were kids, again, I was surrounded by children, by and large. Kids all around me were just, were losing it in the theater. And you must have had a similar experience. I mean, that's one of those things that kids are going to just, and again, it got to me a little bit too for, again, reasons, but I'm curious, you know, how was, you know, again, that, again, your imaginary friend and that kind of concept being a very important, you know, overarching kind of narrative device for this movie. What was that about for you? How did that play for you? What was your experience in the theater? Because if you had a, you know, we're around a child who lost it during, you know, dwarves dying. This one must have been, you know, a theater full of inconsolable children.
I think where my daughter and I were sitting, the kids to my right of me, I don't know how much they were reacting to it. I know my daughter kind of pulled my arm and said, "Where's he going?" She, you know, still wrestling with the concept of death. And I'm wrestling with the concept of trying to explain it to her. So when...
Yeah.
So when Bing Bong, disappears, she, you know, like I said, she looked over at me and she was like, "Where did he go?" And I'm in the middle of a theater. I can't sit there and have a whole conversation with her about it. But, you know, I said, you know, he had to go away, and he's not going to come back. And she said, "Oh," and she was like, "Oh, that's sad." And I said, "Yeah, no, shut up and watch the movie." As far as, you know, kids around me, I don't recall. I mean, I was so involved in my own stuff and my daughter that I don't know if I noticed anything. I will tell you, Richard Kind played the character very well. I thought the character was a great sort of host and guide for our two main characters, you know, in this mystery universe that they were trying to get through, because, you know, those in headquarters did not know where they were going or what they were doing. So I thought his role there was good. I think this leads me to one part of the movie that I just got ultimately frustrated with. I guess I was having a lot of trouble with the journey. I felt like it was a lot of circling around and around and around until they were ready to go home. I know that, you know, you want to give your heroes obstacles to overcome on their journey, but I just, like, I was getting aggravated with where
the story
was going.
It just felt like they
were
throwing obstacles to throw obstacles more than having it kind of unfold naturally as part of the story.
Right. The one thing that made, when they went into the closet there with the clown, I was like, okay, I'm okay with this. When they ended up in the memory dump, I was like, okay. And I was starting to get irritated. But because by this point, I think they've been on the train, and then the train collapsed, and the islands are collapsing, and then the dam broke, and then
and cavalry arrived, but it was too late.
And there was nothing left to do but blow his brains out. It's getting so you have to kill yourself to sell the script these days. But I mean, it just went on
great
forever.
Great trick, but I can only do it once.
And I was just exhausted. I'm like, get to the fucking headquarters already. Make progress. Because I feel like there's this part of the movie where they go absolutely nowhere.
A good chunk of the second act that has very little actual progress.
It's the same 10 yards over and over and over again, to use sort of a football analogy. They just go nowhere. By the time they got to the rocket sled, the spaceship, and it takes them. By the time they finally got out of there, I was like, "Fuck already! I don't care." Like, I wasn't happy about it, because I think it was three or four tries, and on that last one, he bails out and dies and sacrifices himself, and that's sad and everything. But I'm so angry that it took this long. But I was like, all right, whatever. get to headquarters already. And at this point, I don't even remember how they got back. I know they hit the window. I know Joy finds sadness. Sadness doesn't even realize what she's doing. They hit.
Joy winds up sadness is on a cloud. Joy winds up propelling her towards headquarters, then uses a giant mountain of imaginary boyfriends to launch herself onto a trampoline, which she then she bounces across the giant gap, grabs sadness, and splats into the window, which is then cut open by the flaming head of anger.
Yeah, I think at that point I'd had enough. Like, either get there or end this movie. I couldn't take it anymore. And again, That's the narrative issue. I felt like, you know, but as far as narrative issues go, it's not as bad as Tomorrowland, at least. Nothing didn't make sense in this movie. Everything made sense. I just felt like they were stretching things out because they didn't have enough stuff to fill a 90-minute runtime. So they threw things in there.
Which is entirely possible.
Yeah. This movie is very high concept, but low on important things happening as far as obstacles in the narrative. It's very much like Tomorrowland. There's a message here and an important message, and I think it's something that kids need to see, but I feel like the writers really struggled with giving you a strong narrative to get all the way through. This movie lives and dies, though, by its emotional heartstrings and what the message is, which, you know, makes it superior to Tomorrowland. But I think people giving it like 5 stars and near perfect are overlooking the narrative problems.
Well, personally speaking, I would say this is one of the my top 3 best Pixar movies rotates based on where I am emotionally at any given point in time, because they're all very well done. I mean, for me, it's 1A, it's 1A, 1B, and 1C, and that's Toy Story 3, Up, and now Inside Out, and again, whatever order suits me at the moment. And I don't think this is you're completely right about that second act. There's a lot of stuff kind of thrown in there that doesn't serve the overall narrative so much as it does, you know, add a little bit of runtime to this.
It took less time for Frodo and Sam to get to Mount Doom.
Now that's absolutely untrue.
That's what it felt like. By the time Frodo gets to Mount Doom, I'm with him. I'm like, okay, this took an adequate amount of time. I understand your journey. By the time Joy finally gets back to headquarters, I was like, you should have done this 20 minutes ago.
At the very least, somewhere in the neighborhood of 5 to 10.
Sure. But getting back to the Bing Bong character, I like the use of the imaginary friend. I think the imaginary friend is something that, you know, it is normal. It is normative for children to have one. It was also normative for children to abandon it. But that's kind of Pixar's thing, isn't it? Is that everything has feelings and is alive, and it's a very much a Toy Story kind of a thing where you don't know that you're hurting something because you didn't know it was a thing. you didn't know it was an entity. So how could she know? And then his sacrifice is meaningful. Like I said, it was just, you know, it came a little late for me. I read Jeff Harris from 41mania.com's review, and I have no major problem with it. He focused a lot on Richard Kind and thought he was the best casted character in the movie. I would disagree with that. Lewis Black was hilarious in this and produced the most laughs out of me. More so than Richard Hader. Bill Hader. Yeah, more so than Bill Hader. The only other thing that made me laugh hard was the running gag with the triple dent gum. Because every time they did that, I laughed. I laughed hard. I barely laughed. I love a good running.
Lewis Black also benefits from proper exposure and use. And I wound up talking about this with one of my brothers about Mark Wahlberg. Oddly enough. But proper usage of a character is very important. You couldn't do a whole movie with Lewis Black as Anger. It wouldn't work.
Right.
Him as a method for jokes and whatnot is fine. He's one of the highlights because he's used appropriately. I mean,
he's also your secondary villain. I mean, he's not malicious in any way. He's acting out of what he feels is the right thing. He's kind of like the perfect villain in that, you know, we've talked in the past. This is a person who truly believes they are doing the right thing, but in actuality are hurting the person or the entity or the thing that they are attempting to do good by. You know, everything he does to Riley without Joy there to stop him is hurtful, but he doesn't know that. He's thinking he's doing the right thing. You know, he's doing what comes natural. And so he is a villain. He is a thing they are trying to stop, essentially. But
he plants the idea that, hey, we should run away from home. Yeah.
Right.
12-year-old girl taking a bus from San Francisco to Minnesota by herself. That's not the setup for a Silence of the Lambs sequel or anything.
No, that's that's an Amber Alert waiting to happen. But he was perfectly cast. I mean, you're never going to find, you know, when he got that call from the agent, like, we'd like you to play Anger, his response was, of course they do. What else could I possibly play?
I think the biggest thing I laughed at that he did was actually he averted a meltdown. It's when Riley's a kid and they're trying to feed her broccoli and he's ready to throw a tantrum. And then the dad busts out the airplane and he goes, oh, never mind. We got an airplane. It's all good.
I enjoyed, there was a couple of sight gags that I thought were really funny involving Anger. The bit where all the characters, all the emotions in the father's head are all anger.
The bus driver at the end, they all looked like anger.
Okay, I thought it was the dad as well.
They all have mustaches in the dad's head because the dad has a mustache. And in the dad, anger is the, again, to use your phrase about joy with Riley, anger's kind of the one running the show. The dad, and sadness is actually running the mom, and that I got kind of a kick out of that. But going through DEFCON phases to put the foot down was hilarious.
Right. That's what I was getting to too. I enjoyed that entire interplay. At the end of the movie, where Riley sees the boy in the hockey rink, and all his emotions go insane.
Girl over and over again, and all of his panic or his fear emotion is like in the fetal position in a corner. Everyone else is running around. Nothing makes sense to a 12-year-old boy who's been confronted by a girl.
I had a good laugh at that. I mean, every time they showed something going on in somebody else's head, I had a good laugh. Overall, as far as where I would rank this, I mean, one of my favorite Pixar movies is The Incredibles. That's up there with Toy Story 3. And I would say, this is up there as well. I thoroughly enjoyed the movie. Obviously, I don't, just because I cry at something doesn't mean I don't like it. It's one of those where, like, you're sitting there as a creative person, like, what if we did a movie about the voices in your head? And it comes close to being executed very well. It's not perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but I don't know if anybody in Hollywood said they could have gotten a better picture put together.
I don't think anyone else could have come close. The right people at Pixar make magic, and in this particular instance we had... what is his first name? Peter. We had Pete Docter directing it. He also directed Up, which ought to make you happy. he's been around Pixar a lot, and this is his second kind of solo directing effort. And he's got a good feel for that, for what he's trying to do as far as that goes. You had, again, the right people doing the story and the screenplay and everything. Yeah, I shudder to think what, another studio, another bit of people would have done with this, because they would have butchered it horribly.
Can we just talk about sadness for a minute? Phyllis Smith did a really good job of not overplaying her character. There's a tendency to play that kind of character as a bit more stereotypical, a bit more overdone. I wasn't just more. Oh gosh, who is the? There's another character that's just sad all the time, and I can't remember who I'm thinking about. But it's just a little Johnny one note, and I really felt like for a character that is supposed to be the embodiment of sadness, she was as well rounded a character as you're going to see in a Hollywood movie. And it was the same thing with Joy. I like the fact that, despite the fact that these are supposed to be living embodiments of emotion, they were actually well-rounded characters with flaws and everything else. And it was not the same gag over and over and over again, which was a testament to the writing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you have joy, experiencing, you know, anxiety, sadness at various points. And then you have, you know, Sadness, who really just kind of wants to do her job to the best of her abilities. And again, there's no, like you said, there's none of these that venture into the realm of stereotype. I mean, even, you know, again, fear, disgust, and anger, which we spend less time with, they're not, that's not all they feel. They're not just gags.
Right.
They're used that way from time to time. Again, disgust making flames shoot out of Anger's head and then using him to cut open the window, I thought was a great sight gag.
I was fine with it. I mean, let's put it this way. I would have accepted anything, you know, to get the fucking movie going. Getting them back to headquarters. I tell you all I have to say about it. I don't think it's really important as to why I was crying almost the entire movie. I mean, it was an emotionally wrought movie. But I think the idea that somebody is who was formerly viewed to be a menace and not useful is seen as important. I think that's what I keyed into. It was okay, do your job, but then the job is maudlin. You know, that whole scene, you've got sad music and a girl crying. I mean, you'd have to be a monster not to react to that in some way. I'm not saying you have to be bawling your eyes out like I was, but I think if you're sitting there and you're watching this and you have no reaction, see a doctor quick because you're a sociopath.
Yeah, pretty close. I don't really have anything else to add as far as the movie itself goes. I really think you should see this movie. Again, it's an interesting illustration of, again, proper emotional health by and large. And I appreciate that. Again, as someone who for, you know, so many years was depressed and again, I don't want to go too far into it. I suffer from depression, still do, did for a long time. I've got it more under control now. Yay, medication and proper therapy. But it took a long time to get here, and seeing, you know, again, a representation that emotional health is not just plastering a smile on your face and, boy, everything's going to be great in the morning.
Yep.
I appreciated that.
Normative emotions are important in situations that call for them. You know, it is healthy to be afraid when you're in danger. It is healthy to be sad when things are not going well for you and, you know, your connections to things that are important are broken. I think that was an important message of the movie. I don't know how much of it, you know, kids keyed into. See, it's very weird with kids. We talk about this on the wrestling podcast a lot. You know, kids are very visual, but I don't know how much, we're pushing abstract thinking on them at earlier and earlier ages, whether or not that's even developmentally appropriate. And this is not an education podcast, so I'm going to stop there. So I don't know how much of what the movie's message was really made it to the kids that were the target audience, but I certainly think it hit home with a lot of adults. And that is the magic of a Pixar movie, is that it works on all levels.
I don't think I've ever seen a studio so able to entertain both children and adults at the same time.
They do a better job of it than Dream Theater or Dreamcatcher.
DreamWorks.
There you go. DreamWorks do. DreamWorks, I think...
they aim for the teenage to early adults with, you know, stuff like Kung Fu Panda, Shrek.
What's the word I'm looking for here? Something with a P. Something to audience. Panda! I think DreamWorks tends to pander to their audiences where Pixar doesn't. But that being said, you know what's up next, don't you? July 1st it premieres, and then we'll be talking about it the following Wednesday for Terminator Week. Terminator Genesis.
That movie is going to suck. Out loud.
Look, I'll say it again. Neither one of us hated Tomorrowland. There were problems with it. neither one of us hated Fury Road. My objection was that everyone was overpraising it, which I thought was unnecessary. You know, had it not had the praise that it was, that whole review would have been different. But there has not been a bad movie yet this summer that we've seen. Every review that we've done has been generally positive. Oh boy, we might hit our first stinker.
First of many.
Well, I don't think Minions will be terrible. I don't think.
No,
Ant-Man,
but
I mean,
Pixels is not too long after that.
Well, looking at what's left on the list here, Terminator Genesis, that looks to be our first surefire stinker of a movie. Minions, Ant-Man, both of which are getting high praise. Pixels is, you know, that's a 50-50. Mission Impossible 5, I've heard good things about.
It has Adam Sandler in it.
Yeah,
this will be
joke.
Lucky if it doesn't suck. Adam Sandler has not been in anything good in well over a decade.
And then Fantastic Four, I'm prepared for it to be awful.
It's going to suck. I saw when I went to see, I can't remember what it was, it might have been The Avengers, Age of Ultron. I finally got a slightly longer preview for Fantastic Four. I was sitting, you know, surrounded kind of by people who are familiar with comics and whatnot, and everybody looked at that movie, heard that and groaned. There was an audible groan throughout the entire theater when that
That's
preview
fantastic.
Was done.
Love it. All right. Tomorrow night, the Metal Hammer of Doom, we're going to be reviewing the new White Snake, which is basically just cover re-recordings of old Deep Purple songs when Dave Coverdale was in the band. So I'm looking forward to that because I like White Snake and I really like this album. So it should be a fun listen. The week after July 1st is Terminator Week, so there'll be a lot of Terminator-themed podcasts, including Long Road to Ruin, the Terminator trilogy, and when I say trilogy, I mean three movies, not four.
You really ought to do Salvation.
No, absolutely not. It was not part of the original trilogy.
The original wasn't even supposed to be a trilogy. Let me ask you something here, real briefly. Why is it that no one but James Cameron can make a good Terminator movie?
Because I don't think anyone understands why Terminator 2 was good. It's the more dinosaurs thing. They saw a lot of explosions and a lot of, you know, gunplay and all of that, and thought, okay, well, the way to make a good Terminator movie is, throw a bus in the air, have elongated chase scenes where we smash heads into toilet bowls. That'll be good. And there was no, and let's not deal with any of the psychosocial or emotional factors that made Terminator 2 so good.
Yeah, it's, and let me go on record, it's a real shame because the first two Terminator movies are some of my favorites. And the fact that nobody else seems to have anything approaching a handle on this is just, it kind of boggles my mind. This isn't, look, James Cameron is a filmmaker, has a lot of good points, but he's not, again, kind of a nuanced genius for, I mean, there are certain properties that no one else can do properly. I mean, like, I'm not surprised that we can't get a decent Jurassic Park sequel, in large part because Steven Spielberg has his own kind of magic that he weaves. James Cameron is not one of those people. He has things that he does very, very well, and I don't mean this as an end. Look, Michael Bay, much less talented, but the same type of thing, in that I think anyone could make a decent Transformers movie. And I think almost anyone could do a better job than him at certain things. But the point being, for some reason, no one can kind of get their head around the Terminator franchise. And it confuses me. Because it's not that complicated.
I hope to tell you. And so if people are wondering, like, what's going on with the Jack Ryan series on Long Road to Ruin, we'll be doing it at the end of July. Just there are a lot of scheduling conflicts, a lot of stuff going on. We have to break in the middle to do Terminator, and then there's going to be, I think, two back-to-back Metal Hammer of Dooms. We're going to be looking at High on Fire and something else that I'm driving Robert nuts over. And then at the end of the, after that, we'll be finishing up the Jack Ryan movies, as I recall. I'm not looking directly at the schedule. But like I said, in the middle of all that, we've got Terminator Genisys, Minions, Ant-Man, Pixels, and that gets us through, and then Mission Impossible 5, and that gets us through all of July. Somewhere in the middle of July, we'll be doing an Orange is the New Black review. That had to get put off because, again, life got in the way and just, you know, things happen. So we'll eventually get back on schedule. It's just been it's been a rough summer between Sean and I in real life, but we will get it done. We promise.
And I'm not going to be the one to call you a liar, not at this particular venue, at least. Real quick before we go, Inside Out, best movie we've reviewed so far.
It's at the top of the list. Avengers is at the top. This is at the top. Jurassic World, I think, is pretty close to the top. Yeah, it's definitely one of the best ones we reviewed this summer.
Because honestly, and I mean, I don't. This is, again, you've touched on some of the issues. This is not a perfect movie. But I'm looking at, you know, kind of everything that's come out so far this year. And again, all of the Oscar contenders wait to come out until, you know, October through December is kind of their season. Yeah, but this is probably, I mean, all things considered, I would imagine this is, again, if it's not the best movie released thus far, it's one of the top two or three probably. And I'm struggling to come up with something that I would place above it.
I honestly, and I know this, you're probably going to hear this, and I just don't understand you, but I'm having a hard time finding something that beats the Avengers so far.
I can understand that point. I disagree, but I can understand that.
My only issue, I'm being hailed to do another podcast, so we got to wrap this up.
Finish your point, and then we'll do this. Then you can go hang out with your real friends.
Don't you do that. Don't you be that guy. my only issue was with the Avengers was it took a little. It was a little too short from, you know, the inventing of Ultron to Ultron goes crazy. But I just feel like, you know, it was a bit, you know, the movie's a bit of a turducken. They have to shove a lot of things inside of it. In order to get to Civil War and then eventually to get to the Infinity War. So I kind of forgive Josh Whedon for that. But other than that, I thought the movie worked out just fine. Things made sense. I don't understand some of the criticisms of the movie, as we've discussed before. You know, when I think about what we've looked at, starting with The Fast and the Furious.
Cinderella.
Cinderella was pretty much damn near perfect.
In a lot of ways, yeah. There's almost no errors of execution.
It was pretty darn near perfect. We both had fun with The Fast and the Furious. I mean, we had our complaints, but neither one of us thought it was a bad movie by and large. I thought the Avengers was the strongest movie in the summer. Fury Road, I thought looked great, but I didn't think there was much to it. You know, than you know, a 2-hour car chase. But apparently, everyone thinks I'm crazy.
You're not crazy. We just disagree.
You know, San Andreas was 2 hours of watching buildings fall down.
Yep.
Tomorrowland had a bunch of narrative problems. Tomorrowland, I still say, is the worst movie we've seen yet, and it wasn't that bad of a movie.
No, if that stays the worst movie we review, I'm going to be happy.
Yeah.
It's not, and then I'm going to be happy if it does.
And Jurassic World was fun, but I didn't think there was much more to it than that. I mean, I don't think it spoke to, other than, you know, talking about, you know, man's need to make things bigger and badder to our, you know, and much to our demise. You know, and our consumerism is going to kill us. The movie didn't speak to any greater truth than that, and it was just basically, you know, 2 hours of running from Godzilla. So Okay. I thought it was a better Godzilla movie than last year's Godzilla. But,
whoa. Watch yourself.
But that being said, I mean, I would say Inside Out is as close to the Avengers as I'm willing to rate any movie. Or Cinderella, for that matter.
All right. And on that note, we're going to go ahead and wrap this up. We will be back, next week?
The week after.
All right, we'll be back on the 8th, so no podcast on the 1st. And we will be, God help us, reviewing Terminator Genesis. It should really be subheadlined, "Hey, we gave away the whole plot in the trailer."
I'm trying so hard not to watch the trailers because of that.
Apparently, the whole synopsis and whatnot is online. There are scripts. I mean, I haven't done any of that. I refuse to do that. That's just pointless at this stage. I have seen trailers for the movie, and you should not give away your story in a trailer. That's the definition of stupidity. And
it makes me wonder what more to this movie there is. Because if there's nothing more to this movie than John Connor is now a Terminator, I'm going to be really disappointed.
I'm going to be tempted to throw stuff at the screen. I mean, I'm not going to, because I like the theater I'm going to, and I want to support them and continue to be welcome back in their establishment. But if there's a small child seated next to me, I might have to punch it. That's the kind of anger we're dealing with.
All right, what are you doing this Friday and Sunday? Go.
This Friday, I'm not sure about it. I have to double-check, because I agreed to cover Bellator 139, which is headlined by, God help us, Czech Congo and Alexander Volkov. I agreed to cover that, and if that's this Friday, I won't have a podcast because I'll be doing coverage. Yay me.
And on Sunday, you're going to be talking about how the UFC should just call it quits because they've been promoting Aldo versus Conor McGregor for what seems like 20 years, and fucking Aldo injured his rib, sparring.
The fight is not off, first of all. Let's get that out there right now.
There's
Aldo is not pulling from the event.
There's articles out there saying he's out until October.
The type of injury he has might take that long. However, at the moment, he is still good to go, and there's not a medical reason to keep him from fighting. Now, there's still another week, so that might change, and apparently Chad Mendes is in Vegas making weight in case he has to step in to fight McGregor for the interim belt. But as of right now, Aldo McGregor is still on. We will be reviewing UFC Fight Night 70. The United States visa system absolutely violated that card with a barbed wire baseball bat.
I almost went to Hollywood, Florida to go see that. For people who are geographically disinclined, Tampa is about 2.5 to 3 hours away from the Miami West Palm Beach area where Hollywood, Florida is. And because of reasons, I took this weekend off from work and was going to take my wife down to Hollywood, Florida to see Lyoto Machida versus Yoel Romero. And then we found out that the cheapest ticket for the venue was $95 a piece. And we said, it ain't worth it.
It wasn't worth that even when the card was intact.
However, if the Assembly passes the MMA bill in New York, And they make a card for Madison Square Garden December 5th or 6th, whatever the date is, I'm going, damn it. I don't care how much tickets are. I will be at Madison Square Garden for UFC's first New York show.
Plus, you'll get to meet Ben. That'll be nice.
Yeah.
And you could hop over to New Jersey and say hi to Pat, although why you'd want to be in New Jersey is beyond me.
Yeah, I don't know if that's going to happen. All right. Anything else?
Here I am planning out your vacation. All right, and this Sunday, the 411 Ground and Pound radio show, again, reviewing UFC Fight Night 70, and we will be talking about some of the UFC's woes. I will curse people ad nauseum for tuning in to see Kimbo Slice versus Ken Shamrock. Over 2 million of you people! What's the matter with you?
I was one of them. Check out my report.
Yes, I'm going to try and get something up in the MMA zone of 411 Mania. I had a couple of different ideas kicking around, then, Aldo's potentially injured. Might have something on injuries as far as in MMA goes, and just nothing drastic. I'm not Again, nothing drastic, but just, you know, that's kind of the lead idea I've got. Or I can once again praise UFC strawweight champion Joanna Jędrzejczyk for being a total badass, because she's awesome.
Yes,
but anyway, be on the lookout for all of that. Mark and I will be back in 2 weeks on the 8th, and we will ream Terminator Genesis, because it's going to deserve it. I'm 90% sure. Until then, for Mark Radulich, I'm Robert Winfrey, thanking you all again for being here and reminding you to be well, be safe, and behave.
Help me.